Welcome to the High Velocity Radio Show. High Velocity Radio is brought to you by PSI Digital Media Experts, the market leader in delivering digital media services. From manufacturing millions of CDs and DVDs to turnkey e-commerce solutions and streaming high-definition video over their worldwide content distribution network, PSI has the solutions to meet your needs. Find PSI at psidiscs.com, psidiscs.com. The High Velocity Radio Show is where we celebrate innovative professionals producing better results in less time. Produced and directed by Lee Cantor and brought to you live from Radio X Studio in Atlanta, Georgia. Now here are your hosts, Todd Schnick and Stone Payton.
Welcome to the High Velocity Radio Show. This is your host, Stone Payton, and my co-host, Todd Schnick, is AWOL. He's stuck somewhere on Johnson Ferry Road, but we'll probably hear from him here in a little while. But joining me in the studio this morning is our producer Lee Cantor. What's happening, Lee?
Nothing much. Just slumming with you here in the studio. It's been a while, Stone. How you been?
I know. It has been a while since you and I have been on the air together. So what'd you do this weekend?
It was a kid's weekend. My kid interviewed the author of Diary of a Wimpy Kid, and the movie's coming out. So he got to meet the stars of the movie and did a whole thing. So we have that coming up.
Yeah, and that's Max Cantor. And what's the name of his show?
Kid Power Radio.
Kid Power. I mean, he has some track record for interviewing stars, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. Better than mine.
I know. We should have him booking our show.
I know. Where were you last week?
What did we do last week? We skipped last week.
Yeah, so I figured you were out having a party somewhere.
No, I think
traveling.
You know what? I think I just laid up and played hooky.
Oh, nice.
I don't remember. I don't have a very good short-term memory.
I can notice that.
It's just the college years.
Payback.
Catching up with me. Absolutely. So I was at the Cobb Symphony Orchestra yesterday.
Man, you're a regular now.
I know. That's cool. You know, I'm on the payroll for a little while anyway till they get it figured out.
That's good. So what's happening over there?
Well, it was fun because, you know, I'm not much of a symphony veteran, so I was expecting something a little more hoity-toity, something a little more structured, and it was the production was called Carousel, and it had a chorus, and it had a symphony orchestra, and it was more of a story. It was almost like a play, and my mother is up from Pensacola this weekend, so I took her and my youngest daughter, who is also a cello player. So it was
nice.
Yeah, and they gave us the real, you know, they gave us the star treatment. We got the box seats and the whole bit.
So how long was it before you fell asleep?
I didn't. I'm telling you,
really?
It was great.
That means it's a thumbs up then, right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Good stuff.
So we had a good time. And we're going to have a good time here this morning as well. First up on the High Velocity Radio Show, this gentleman is the president and CEO of Lynx Wagging Tails. He's an author, speaker, and animal communicator. Please join us in welcoming Tim Link. Welcome to the show, Tim.
Hey, thanks for being here. I appreciate it.
Well, we are delighted to have you, but you got to tell us right off the bat, what in the world is an animal communicator?
Right. Well, you know, animal communicator is someone that can connect and understand the levels of the animals at the level that they communicate. So let me explain that a little bit further. Animals communicate on what we call a telepathic or an intuitive connection. So this is when we say geese are flying in pattern. So we see Canadian geese flying in pattern. You have a lead goose and a goose in the back. When they get tired and they fall out of formation, the one in the back comes to the front and the one in the front goes to the back. Well, they don't stop, land to the ground, have a little squawking contest to see who's going to take the lead. They know. They already communicate without using spoken words, without using spoken tones, who's going to take the lead and how that's going to continue, how that path is going to continue. So they speak at that level. And I just have a gift that understands them at that level, and they share information with me in forms of words, colors, feelings, emotions, everything the animal goes through, a human goes through, and we connect at that level. So it sounds you're still puzzled. It's just
well,
I see
I'm absolutely
the deer in the headlight look there.
Well, I'm absolutely fascinated by it, and at the same time, of course, I observe these things in nature. I've seen a bunch of fish at all of a sudden. I mean, a whole school turn on a dime. I've obviously watched the geese turn like you're describing.
Right.
I guess my next question is: can you make a living at this?
Well, we're paying the bills, and we're doing better every single day. You know, we'll go in a little bit more by background because this wasn't something, you know, I'd always planned on doing. This wasn't part of my career path, and I don't think it's something we offer in high school or college classes here. But it is one of those things where I think it is a leap of faith that I took. It's something that I felt that this is where I needed to be to give the animals a voice and help people build that best relationship possible between themselves and the animals. And so the work that I do absolutely does that every single day.
Now, do you do all animals?
Yeah, you know, when I first started this, it was mostly domestic animals. So I'd get calls from people that, for their dogs and cats and horses. But then we find out that domestic animals are quite broad in nature nowadays. You know, our children, they don't want to go to the hassle of walking a dog every single day and picking up after the dog.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah. So then you start seeing some animals that they bring in, things like lizards and snakes and these type of things. And they all communicate in the same fashion. And then my book, Wagging Tails, Every Animal Has a Tail, was endorsed by Jack Hanna, the Academy.
Or oh, wow. You can't ask for any better than that.
He's my favorite guest on, David Letterman?
Yeah, absolutely. He is the guy that's on Letterman and all the other shows bringing those crazy critters on. And Jack had a chance to read my book, loved it, and gave us an endorsement. And since then has turned us on to animals in zoos and sanctuaries and aquariums. So it's quite broad. And the thing to keep in mind is all animals communicate in the same level. And we can communicate at that level as well. We just have to get up to that level and get back to that level. I try to explain to people that we all have heard of mother's intuition.
Right.
A mother's intuition. So you have an infant child there. The child can yell and scream and coo and all these things, but it hasn't formed its vocabulary. So the only way it can connect with the mother is through that intuitive connection, through that telepathic connection. And that's when a mother gets those gut feelings. She sees that little Timmy needs something, but she's not quite sure what it is. She gets those feelings. Well, that's part of this intuitive thing, and he's connecting with her at that level. The challenge comes about by the time we get to our school ages, we tend to forget all about that. We learn our vocabulary. We learn how to speak like you and I are speaking today.
Right.
And we forget all about that connection that we have, that intuitive, that telepathic connection, and we forget it. And so we have to get back to that level if we want to be able to connect with our animals at a deep level and give them a voice.
Well, you know, I saw something about a week ago. It was a sporting event. It was cliff diving. And these people were diving from 300 or 400 feet in the air. And it occurred to me, how does someone know if they're good at something like that?
It's that first time.
And I got the same question of you. When did you first realize you had this gift and say, hey, this is something I can do and bring value to people with?
February 2004. So it's one of those things that happened in your life that you know exactly where you were at that time and what was happening. This wasn't something I had planned on doing. There was a half-day workshop that was going on that was taught by an animal communicator by the name of late Judy Byers. Judy's been doing this type of work and intuitive work for over 30 years. And she was teaching a half-day workshop which first taught you how to calm your mind, you know, get rid of that monkey mind, all those little, I call post-it notes on the minds, the honeydews and things you have to do, how to clear that out, how to open your heart. So a lot of calming, a lot of breathing exercise, a lot of meditation. And then we connected with animals. And there were animals, live animals, as well as pictures of animals inside the workshop that people had brought. There were about a dozen pictures of animals. Well, there's actually more than a dozen pictures. There's a dozen people in the class. Each of us had four or five pictures of the animals we wanted to communicate with. And we all had four or five simple questions from those animals, such as where does Spot like to sleep? What color is Fluffy's litter box? Where does Winnie like to eat her hay? Real simple things like this. So if you do the quick arithmetic, and for me, I have to take my shoes off to do this, but you know, there's 12 people in the class. They all have four or five pictures, and they all have four or five questions of each picture. So, you know, you've got over 100 questions. And I would go into this calming state. I'd clear out that monkey mind. I would open my heart. I would ask these questions, and I would receive back information. And the information I was receiving at that time was, you know, a couple of words or a picture. And so I jot it down on my notes, not doubting what I was receiving, just thought it was going to be fun. And I shared it back with the owners, or what I call the human companions of the animal. And every bit of information I was receiving was 100% accurate.
Wow.
For over 100 questions. And, you know, at that time I thought, well, this is cool. This is way out there. Maybe I'm on a roll. Maybe I should just go get some lottery tickets today because I'm really cooking today. Maybe that was the thing. And then how is this going to fit into my life? Because at that time, I was a telecommunications executive. Was a vice president and director of global business development. I traveled the world. I met with the top executives of companies like Texas Instruments, Microsoft, Intel, and I was trying to convince them to spend $20 to $30 million of their money on the technology that I was selling them that went into cell phones. And so how are these worlds going to, you know, come together? You know, it wasn't like I could continue to go to the executive of Intel and say, you know what, if you buy like $30 million worth of my stuff today, my technology today, I'll come by and tell you why Fluffy's no longer using the litter box. I didn't think the world was quite ready for that. Maybe one day, but I didn't think they were quite ready for it at the time. So I think what, like with most people, when you receive gifts of this type and you're not quite sure how it's going to fit in your life, you tend to keep them quiet. And that's what I did for a couple of years, and I continued to work with it and develop it. Worked with my own pets. A few friends found out about it. I started working with them, solving behavior problems and solving emotional and physical problems with their animals. A few more people found out about it, and I started doing work with lost pets, locating lost pets and bringing them back home safely. Mm. And then we got involved in animal rescue and started working with rescue organizations in the area as well as nationwide, and later became the president of a local humane society here in the Atlanta area, which afforded me more, you know, thousands of opportunities to work with animals. And finally, in 2007, I really had to sort of go within myself and ask that big question about what is this really all about? Is this something that I need to keep quiet and continue my 20-year career in telecom, which I was doing quite well with? Or is this what I'm meant to be doing? Is this my purpose for being here, is to help the animals and give them a voice? And my confirmation came through loud and clear that it was definitely the latter, and I shouldn't wait any longer. And so I took that giant cliff dive, as you call it, and dove off the deep end and left my 20-year career behind and started a company called Lynx Wagging Tails. And it's just been a wonderful journey ever since. And we're actually managing to pay the bills, so that's good.
Well, I certainly commend you for that. That's absolutely incredible. You refer to this, and I think rightly so, I'm sure, as a gift. But can it be taught, or can parts of this be taught to the layperson?
Yeah, well, I think all of it can be taught. I think we're all born with this ability to be able to connect at that level and connect with each other at that level as well, because we talked about that earlier, the infant connecting with their mother. This is really no different than that. So I think it can be taught. Now, will it be as deep and as intense as what I've been able to accomplish? I don't know. Maybe over time. You know, when I first started, it was just a few pictures and a few words, and now I'm getting all the sensations, all the information that the animal wants to share with me, and it's an amazing thing. Once you have it, you understand your animals much better. You understand all the animals around you, and it actually helps you relate to people better as well and understand them a little bit better.
So tell us about the book. What's in the book?
Yeah, the book is Wagging Tails, Every Animal Has a Tail, and it's a collection of 32 stories of the animals I've worked with. Most of the stories are of animals at rescues or at foster homes from my very early days of starting this. So you actually see within the book the progression of how this works, you know, how I started as sort of a novice and how the information I received started to grow throughout the book. These stories are about animals that have had behavior problems that we've uncovered and solved, physical problems, emotional problems. These are lost pets, pets that are not in the Atlanta area. Keep this in mind, you don't have to be where you're located at. I've helped locate animals all over the world, France, England,
really?
UK, you name it. Most recently got written up in an article that went nationwide about a cat that in Maryland that helped bring home after 14 months of being away.
Wow.
So we do a lot of work with lost pets, and then we work with people that their animals are sick or injured and are in that transitioning process, helping them decide what's best for their animals and how to deal with that grieving process afterwards. So this book deals with, at a very simple level, 32 stories of the animals I've worked with. And then we tied in about 24 helpful hints, little tips, little things you can do today to better understand your animals and have a great life with them.
So do you run into any skepticism sometimes when you're sharing what you do for a living or how you might be able to help people?
Well, the world's wide open to everything, aren't they? Yeah, there are a few skeptics, and men are the worst.
Really? More so than women?
Definitely.
Imagine that.
Yeah, yeah. You know, we let this little thing called egos get in our way often, and I'm actually one of the very few people in my field that are, you know, male. That's a male.
Huh.
So it makes me a little bit unique in a little bit unique situation. But yeah, you know, we deal with those skeptics. But I think it's the thing, once I try to explain to them at a simple level these things that I mentioned a little bit further, the mother's intuition and how animals connect with each other, they start to understand it and start to realize that this could be something that could help them out. And then when they see the end results, they're amazed. So, you know, with the guys, it's always, if I'm doing it in person, they're hanging out in the kitchen while we're in the living room with the animals, you know, right. And they're peeking their head around the corner pretending not to listen. And then the next thing you know, they're sitting on the couch with us because they start to see the results. And it's the same thing with the phones. We'll get on a phone consultation. About 95% of my consultations are done over the phone. And they'll put it on a speakerphone, and the guy will hang out in the background, and he won't say a word. And then eventually he gets a little closer and a little closer. So it's an amazing thing, and you know, we all love our animals. They're a huge part of our lives. They're part of our family. They're a huge heart connection for us. We want what's best for them. And I have ability to help you better understand that and help solve those problems.
Well, my wife was convinced that she could speak to little man, so... She certainly thought she couldn't. So,
welcome to the show, Todd.
Hey, no, gentlemen. Good morning. It's apologize for being late. You know how Atlanta roads are. So,
We weren't sure that it was you because with the clip-on tie and everything, I had to do a little bit of a double check. You have a real meeting sometime today?
Absolutely. Some of us work.
Well, you know, somebody better you than me.
Right. So I have to ask you, and I apologize for being late. If I step on a question that's already been asked, but are these when you dialogue with an animal, is it a dialogue? Is it a two-way communication, or are you just communicating one way to them?
Right, you know, it is a two-way communication. The way the consultations work is you have questions that you want answered about your animal. You ask me those questions. I will connect with the animal. I will ask them those questions, and I will visualize those questions. Because every time we say a word, the visualization automatically comes out. And I receive information back, and I receive information back in the form that they want to communicate. So, you know, you have some animals that are just like some humans, very flamboyant, very talkative. They'll give me words, colors, feelings, emotions, pictures, the whole gamut. Others are a little bit more subdued. They'll only choose one or two ways of communicating that they think I could best understand at being just a mere human. and that's the information I get back. And so a lot of the times the information I receive back, you know, it's fairly clear. You know exactly what the animal is trying to tell you, and you can take that information and use it and help build a great relationship with your animals. Other times we have to peel back that onion a little bit and sort of decipher what that he's really trying to say or he or she's really trying to say to be able to connect with the animal. But it is a two-way conversation. You can tell the animals through me what you're wanting from them, what you need from them, and in return, they can give you information what they need from you. And that's how we solve problems. And I think the cool thing that I try to do is not only relay this information back and forth, but more importantly, leave you techniques, leave you things that you can do once I've hung up the phone or left the house that you can continue to have these kind of conversations or have this connection with your animals so we don't just leave you high and dry.
What are the most common problems you're called in to solve?
Fluffy will no longer use the litter box. That is the probably the number one that I get. Yeah,
our other guest is saying, yeah, that's the problem for him.
Exactly. And, you know, cats are brilliant. When you take a look at most cats are very self-reliant. They tend to come and go as they please, and they know instinctually how to use the litter box. The way to get our attention is to stop using that litter box. They know that that's the wake-up call, and if we continue to ignore it, you know, they'll stop using it. Maybe they'll use it right outside of the litter box, and if we ignore that, then next thing you know, it's in the living room. Then if we ignore that, it's right in the middle of the master bed. So that'll wake us up for sure. But the reason the cat stops using the litter box is for one of three reasons. Either they're going through a physical problem. There's something physically happening with them. Maybe it's urinary tract infection, kidney infection, whatever it may be. And we try to narrow that down so you can take them to the veterinarian and give your vet a little bit more guidance on what could possibly be happening. It's a mental thing that they're going through. So this could be something that is a change in the household, a change in lifestyle. Maybe you brought another cat into the house without asking this cat ahead of time. So there are some proper decorum there for introducing a new animal into the household. Or it's an emotional problem. And the emotional problem has to deal a lot with us. If we're going through emotional problems, if we're having challenges in our life, if we have what I call low energy, so this is physical things going on with us, emotional, whatever it may be, and we bring that in the house and we continue to bombard that, the animals will pick up on it and they'll have an emotional problem. So we try to determine what three areas are one of the three areas that's causing the problem and see if we can get Fluffy to use that litter box again.
Stone asked you about skepticism, and the way you answered the question was from the marketplace. But you just mentioned helping narrow down a potential problem that a customer can then go to their vet. What do vets think of you? I mean, do they see you as an ally, or how do they handle this?
Well, I think there's two types of veterinarians, actually. You know, I work with a lot of holistic veterinarians. Now, a holistic veterinarian is a trained, licensed, taught, everything's exactly the same as a normal veterinarian, but they're also looking for holistic alternatives. So in addition to treating the animal for the symptom, they look to treat the whole animal. So they could recommend things like acupuncture, chiropractic for the animal, herbs, supplements, flower essences, and they're very open to animal communication. Your traditional veterinarians are slowly coming around to it because, you know, they're trying to solve the problem. And any guidance that they can have to narrow down what the possible problem is, they'll accept it. Now, they may not come out and say, oh, yeah, that Tim Link, yeah, he's brilliant. But they will take the information and they'll use it. And, you know, it does help out. And one of the stories in the book, Wagging Tails, Every Animal Has a Tail, it talks about a cat that I actually went over to see the dog. The dog was having a problem with the young boy who lived next door. The young boy tend to open the door and walk into the neighbor's house without asking, and the dog wasn't too appreciative of that. But as I worked with the dog and we sort of solved that problem, the cat came into the room and was persistent. There was something wrong. So I'd asked the human companion, the owner of the animal, what was going on with the animal. She said, well, he seems to be doing fine. I don't think there's any problem. But as I checked in with the animal and sort of did a body scan, did a check, you know, for his energy to see how his energy was, it led me to the area where the kidneys were. And so I'd asked the cat, you know, are you having problems with your kidneys? And the cat confirmed that it was. And so I asked the owner once again, I said, you know what, has he had any problems using the litter box? She said, well, he's missed it a few times, you know, and now that I think about it, he has had a little bit of problem. I said, well, I don't want to scare you. I'm not a veterinarian, but I would recommend you taking him to the vet and finding out if there's a problem. So she took him in the vet. The vet said, well, we just ran some blood work and some urine work about 3 months ago. Didn't find anything, but if you want to pay the money, we'll do it again. And she said, I would definitely want to pay the money. So she did. They ran the test, and the cat was in the early stages of kidney failure.
Oh, wow.
So if we wouldn't have caught this at the time, then it could have been a major problem. But we did. Proper diet, proper medication. This story's about 2 years old. Saw the cat about a month ago, and he's fat and happy and doing great. So it's a win-win.
So you've written the book, and you've been on an impressive array of different media, radio and some television, and been cited in a lot of print journalism. But how else does an animal communicator go to market? What else are you doing to educate the community about what you do and what you can do to help?
Well, you know, even though this is a gift, it is a business. You know, taking that leap of faith, you know, I'm not a multimillionaire where I could just do this on the side. This is my business. This is how I make my living. So you have to market it just like you do everything else. So I have to be on shows like this and appreciate the opportunity of being here. You get on as many radio shows as you can to sort of spread the word.
You've really hit the big time. I mean, this is the High Velocity Radio.
Well, yeah, so now I can just retire.
Right.
You know, and just do for chump change, do it for fun. It'd be great. But it's, you know, it is a thing you have to market. You have to have an outstanding website. A lot of people go to the website. Mm. You have to make sure your search engines are up high so people can find you first instead of somebody else. You have to be out there meeting and greeting people and doing the work and getting the notoriety. So it is a business, and I think it's one of the things that, you know, people take this leap. If they have this type of gift and they take this leap of faith, they do it out of their heart. But as always, you can't run a business with just your heart. You got to use your brains as well.
So how can our listeners get in touch with you? What's the best way for them to contact you and find out more about your book and get their hands on a copy?
Absolutely. You can go to the website. Best way to find out about everything about Tim Link and Wagging Tails. The website is wagging-tails.com. That's wagging-tales.com because it's all about the stories they tell us, the tales they tell us. And on there, it has all kinds of wonderful information. You can order the book there, or you can go into any major bookstore or order it on your favorite online bookstore as well. And sign up for the free e-newsletter. It's a monthly newsletter that we put out that not only keeps you abreast of what I'm doing and where I'm appearing, but more importantly, we have those helpful hints, those little tips that you need to know that come out each and every month. So take a look at the free newsletter.
Well, before we let you go, Tim, we have a little tradition here on the High Velocity Radio Show. We like to ask each guest, if they would, to share a mistake that they've made at some point in their career, and really, more importantly, what they feel like they've learned from it. Could we get you to do that for us?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, first of all, you know, I look at mistakes. There's really no mistakes because it's all learning process, and some processes of learning is a little more painful than others. But I think with this, the biggest mistake is just time. You know, knowing it's going to take time. You're building a business from scratch. Be prepared that you're not going to be traditionally, you're not going to be an overnight success, and you're not going to make millions right away. You've got to be patient. You've got to be diligent. And one of the big mistakes that I had was, you know, I thought if we put the book out there and we went on a national book tour and we appeared on, you know, 30, 40, 50 TV shows on a national basis and appeared on 200-plus radio shows that, you know, everything's going to be fine and dandy. Be patient. It takes time.
Still takes time.
Still takes time.
Well, thank you so much for joining us this morning. It's been an absolute delight, and I hope you'll come back with more stories and more tales to share.
I'd love to. I appreciate the opportunity.
You are more than welcome. Can you hang out with us for a little while we visit with our next guest?
Yeah, it'll be great.
Terrific. Well, next up on the High Velocity Radio Show, I am delighted to introduce a gentleman who runs a company called Executive Impact. He's a career coach and an author. Please welcome to the show, Richard Kirby. Welcome to the show, Richard.
Thank you, Stone. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we are delighted to have you. I saw you furiously taking notes when we were interviewing our other guests. You must be not an owner, what do we call it, a human companion.
Well, there's some parallels between what Tim does and what I do, but my wife is a little bit of a psychic and kind of gets tuned into animals also. But I was making notes about this issue of his career and things like that, and the fact that people sometimes have to make hard decisions to go with what they truly want to do in life.
So you're a job seeker communicator.
You could say that,
I
yes.
Like that. Yeah.
The job seekers can communicate normally with verbal and nonverbal cues. One of the things that people many times don't realize when they go into an interview is they've done studies that only about 7% of your communication is the actual words. And the way you deliver the words and your body language and other things are important. So just like psychically, if Tim can get tuned in with the animal, even on a less sophisticated level, good interviewers read people while they're interviewing mm-hmm. them. And the people may think, gee, I'm saying all the right things here. I'm acing this interview, when they're giving signals that are not the words that may be hurting them.
That's an interesting point, and one that I suspect a lot of job seekers don't think about when they're preparing for an interview. I mean, they're thinking about what the talking points are going to be, and there's probably more strength to how they position themselves and how they present themselves. That's interesting. Tell us a little bit about what you do.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Well, I am most people would call me, the generic title is career coach. I actually like to brand myself and identify myself as a career consultant. I am a member of the Institute of Management Consultants. I'm the only person that works in careers that's in that organization in the state of Georgia. And so that shows you a little bit of my mindset. What I help people with is anything having to do with the full spectrum of figuring out what they want to do in life from a career standpoint through actually making that happen.
We understand that you've had a unique career path yourself to get from where you started to where you are now. Tell us a little bit about that journey.
Well, I like math and science, so without a lot of career direction, I made a decision going into college to major in electrical engineering. So I went to school 4 years. It wasn't the most fun time in the classroom. I had a lot of fun outside of the classroom, which I think Stone did too, apparently, listening to him. But I came out of college. I had a resume that said basically I have almost no career experience in the job market, other than I have a degree in engineering, so everybody wanted to hire me for an engineering job. I started there, and to make it brief, basically after a few years I recognized even though I was getting promoted and making more money, I didn't really enjoy it. It wasn't enough having to do with people, and I really had a people desire that wasn't being fulfilled in engineering. So I went into human resources, which is an odd career change. You don't find many engineers in human resources. Did that for 4 years in training development, eventually moved into marketing, and mid-career at that point moved into sales. And I was a sales manager for 12 years before I got into this business.
So you're not a career coach, you're a career consultant. What makes you different from the other couple million career coaches that are out there?
Well, that's a great question. actually, one thing that makes me different is what I just mentioned, the breadth of my experience. I mean, if you're going to counsel people on what they should be doing in life or what might be better for them, a breadth of experience from the technical side in engineering to the more touchy-feely human resources to sales and marketing and interpersonal communications, that provides me a great breadth of experience and perspective. I've also worked for pre-IPO venture-funded startups and Fortune 100s, which provides me a breadth of company experiences that's a lot different from most people. So I think perspective is one. Another thing that makes me different is I work predominantly with middle and upper income people. A lot of coaches basically work at all levels. I try to focus more on the middle and upper income people. And I'm more hands-on. I will actually, having been in sales, I'm not afraid to make a cold call. I will actually pick up the phone and call somebody and try to make a personal introduction for my clients.
Well, I like that a lot.
Well, thank you.
No, I would think that would be a little bit unusual, and particularly if you're, you know, a 6-7-figure salesperson and you see that in your career consultant, that's got to give you a tremendous amount of confidence in the rest of the advice that they're providing you. I'm interested to hear about the book, starting with the graphic that you have on the front. You've got the graphic on the front of this book. The book is Fast Track, Your Job Search and Career, and then the subtitle is How to Get Paid What You're Worth by Avoiding Common Career Roadblocks. Tell us about the graphic with the guy driving and the dashboard and all that.
Well, that ties into my family, actually. A lot of the book does. I came up with this concept that I wanted to show. Actually, I worked with my daughter. My daughter went for 4 years to art conservatory, and thankfully she had some help with that. But, you know, she had 150,000 plus college education in how to do art. Okay. So having spent that investment, I decided I wanted to utilize it. So I got to talking with her, and we were thinking climbing the corporate ladder, and we were coming up with brainstorming all these ideas about having some sort of ladder, which some of the career books have on the front. And what we decided to do was think of it more in terms of someone taking control. And when we thought of taking control, the next thing we had was somebody grabbing hold of a steering wheel of a car and looking out the window at a road sign.
That's
how it came up, and my daughter did all the graphics.
Well, so what's the odometer on the car is reading 170, so that's, I hope they have good control.
That's a fast. So you might think of it.
I just saw that.
And so it's kind of like the difference between a person who's sitting on the traditional U.S. highway with a speed limit of 70 and a person who sort of goes off track and they're at Atlanta Motor Speedway, and there's not a limit there.
Yeah. Apparently someone had that same problem as
well. Well, when you go off track, I don't mean in the ditch, of course.
So what's between the covers?
Well, what's between the covers is a fairly good synopsis of many of the things I do every day with my clients. It's the gamut from I start with attitude. The first chapter is about attitude. I believe without the proper attitude, you're in a little way self-defeating. Right off the bat, the second chapter is on belief system, and that might sound odd for a career book, but I really believe your attitude and what you believe in your heart and in your mind is extremely important. And then I get into the fundamentals, like how to figure out what type of occupation you're best fitted for, all the way through interviewing, networking, negotiating, and those types of things that people need to do to go find jobs.
Well, just like there's a lot of career coaches, there's a lot of books about
Absolutely.
This. So why is your book different? What stands it apart from the rest?
Well, first of all, it's based upon the day-to-day strategies that I use and I see working in my practice. There are a lot of theories of what you should be doing, and you'll read a lot of books of people who maybe long ago did some of this stuff but haven't been doing it for 10 years, and we know the market has changed. So the biggest thing is that these are things that are actually working in the marketplace. The second thing is there's a lot of critical information that's been overlooked in other books. And I just mentioned two things, attitude and belief system. I haven't found career books tend to discuss those types of things, and particularly strategic networking. What I'm trying to do is apply marketing and sales principles to the job search which few people have tended to do. So if I remember correctly, you're a Seth Godin fan or whatever.
Oh, sure.
So I actually quote him in my book. I'm the only career book that has a Seth Godin quote, I think. And it has to do with permission marketing. I use the principle that he has in his book of permission marketing all the time. So you don't find many career coaches who've read marketing books and are quoting marketing people in how they should go about their job search.
And I don't think you see that very often, and that boggles my mind because you're marketing yourself.
Exactly.
You use the same principles.
And when you go into the job seeker groups around town, and I speak as a guest quite a bit, one of the things you do frequently hear is the person leading the group, they've got 20, 50, 100 job seekers out here who are really stressed, under stress, and they're trying to figure out how to go find a job. And the leader will stand up and say, how many people are in sales? And maybe, 10, 20% typical sample will say they're in sales. And then they always come back with, no, all of you are in sales now. Well, how do you tell that 80% that didn't raise their hand the first time how to go sell themselves? That's a real challenge.
Majority of the people you work with, unemployed, or do you work with people that are looking to make a change in their career, or both?
I work with both. I would say in this market, it's probably 60 to 70% unemployed.
Wow.
In a more normal market, it might be more like 50-50. So what many people don't know is you look at the statistics. Let's say they came out with the 10.8% unemployment rate in Atlanta in the recent Journal Constitution. There's far more people than that who are employed who are looking than the people who are unemployed and looking.
And what advice do you have for someone who is in a job and unhappy and looking to make a change in their career? What are some things they should think about?
Well, I think first realize that when they do surveys, they find that roughly half the population readily admits they feel they're in the wrong occupation. So I would say if you're standing there and you're not happy in your job, don't think, well, gee, why am I so picky? Why can't I be happy in what I'm doing? Well, a lot of times it's because the person really hasn't had the guidance or chosen the right career path.
Or the courage that our first guest had
in
making a leap of that kind of stature.
That's absolutely true. But most people I find the challenge is they don't have that direction of where they do want to go. Tim had the moment of clarity where he recognized what he had or what he was maybe on a mission to do. And he was fortunate to have that. Many people don't have that moment of clarity without digging deeper.
How would you go about choosing some professional support like you? So I'm a six-figure salesperson. I'm not happy where I am, or maybe I've even been let go. But I have enough sense to know that one thing I don't know how to do is go get a new job. What are some things that I could do to make some good choices to hire someone like you to help me?
Well, that's a great question, and since I am pro-coaching and pro-consulting, and I do say at the beginning of the book, if you don't like that, then just ignore my comments, but I do have it sprinkled throughout there. I actually felt, well, how can I talk positively about my profession without giving people tools of how to buy it, because it's something people don't buy very regularly.
Yeah.
So I actually have a chapter in the book about how to shop, what career coaches do and how to shop for a career coach. There's actually an exercise in there, step by step, people can go through to qualify whether the career coach is qualified and whether they're the type of person they should be working with. So it's in the book.
No, that's great.
Now, as far as just a brief idea, anybody can build a website. So you want to look deeper than that, obviously. You would like to talk to existing clients or former clients, somebody like you who could give you an idea of what the service was really like. I would recommend you look and see what they write on paper. I mean, I have a book. I have a lot of articles. And my strategy is to really get people to get inside of my head and understand how I operate, and then they can make a reasonable decision. Does this guy sound like he knows what he's talking about? And make sure you know who you're getting. I'm not going to get into the big shops other than to say there are a couple of national, you might say, chains are multi-unit offerings, service offering companies, whatever, that routinely churn people through their offices. They have Class A office space with marble on the floor, and they churn dozens of people every week through their process. What you don't see in that process is who you're actually working with. You see a salesperson who's selling you what the service is. So I would always recommend make sure you meet the person you're going to be working with before you buy any service.
That sounds like good advice.
Many people don't, though. In those shops, the deal is to get them to sign the paper and get them started, and then they find out who they're working with afterward. So that's number one. You got to know who you're working with and whether you have confidence in that person.
And I suspect that the person seeking the help is probably a little anxious and nervous and doesn't
yes.
think enough to make that the right decision on who they're working with.
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah. That is true many times. You know, when you're under stress and, as you said, when you're anxious, you decide, well, what I'm doing isn't working. Maybe these people know more than me. Let me just go sign up and see what happens.
So you gave some advice to those that are unhappy in their career and looking to make a change. What are some tips and help for those that are currently unemployed?
Well, the first thing I want to do is assure the unemployed people, many of which, when you look over an audience, they do look, as a group, somewhat depressed. At the minimum, deflated. And I would argue the majority of the group, because I see the groups all the time and I speak to them, the majority normally look some level almost of depressed, and I think that's because of the media, not you guys, of course.
But, no, not us.
But of course not.
That left-wing liberal.
Yeah, I heard you guys were with the Republican Party or whatever. I'm a libertarian, so, you know, that just shows where
you're
I'm
to the right
from.
Of us, all right.
Yeah. So, anyway, the first thing I'd want to emphasize is that I actually recommend to people to stop consuming popular media. If I look at the paper and it says the unemployment rate's gone up, if I turn on the talk radio and they're talking about how bad the employment situation is and ragging on the current administration as if beating up Obama is going to get us more employed people or something. You know, all these negative things that keep reinforcing, I recommend stop listening to that stuff. And then obviously they need to replace that with something positive reading, affirmations, visualization, whatever it is, a positive support group. I'd also encourage the unemployed people to actually come up with a plan of action. You would be surprised, but I'd say the majority of people do not have any plan of action that they could even write down in four or five sentences. And as they say in management, if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. What is their manageable results they're working toward? I'd say one out of every 25 job seekers has any kind of even one-page plan of action, and less than that have some type of measurement to say what they're doing, is it working or not?
That actually does not surprise me, because I work with a lot of small business people who don't have a plan on how to grow their business and all that. So I'm not surprised by that stat at all.
Why are you looking at me when you say that?
And the last thing I want to throw in there is frequently I will meet with people, and I'm a big fan of one-on-one networking, getting in front of people over coffee, making a personal connection, trying to get referrals. It's really referral marketing is one of the things I preach. And many times people say, well, I don't feel comfortable doing that. So my immediate reaction is, okay, you got to get out of your comfort zone. If you want a job, you can't do everything that's necessarily comfortable for you. That would be my third point to unemployed people. Get out of your comfort zone.
Do you think there's a role for the social web to play in this process for people?
Oh, absolutely. I'm a huge fan of LinkedIn. As you know, LinkedIn is by far the runaway leader in social networking and social media. I've been on LinkedIn for about 5.5 years. When I got there were about 1 million people on LinkedIn. They hit 50 million a few months back. So I've got 3,800 direct connections. I looked up you guys. You got 200, 300, 400, which is fine. It depends on your philosophy. My philosophy was build my network as broad as I could, but focused on people who were well-connected, people like recruiters, HR people, hiring managers. So I have made a strategic growth of my LinkedIn network so that I can reach out now. First, second, third levels, I have about 15 million contacts, which is about a quarter of all the LinkedIn contacts that exist and about half of the U.S. ones.
Now, it's obvious that someone who's even a six or certainly a six figure out of work executive should be active and present on a tool like LinkedIn.
Yes.
But do you think they should be blogging and sharing the knowledge that they've attained over their career?
I would say, you know, let's take Tim's example of his book. He went on all these radio, TV shows and got all this press, and he's still building. It's not overnight success. I would say if you got 2 or 3 years and you want to gradually build a base of followers and create credibility for yourself, you could spend a lot of time doing that. However, if you want a job in 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, I would say be very sparing with it. Now, if you can be very targeted and put something on paper that shows you are a marketing guru and you're looking for a marketing job, it is possible someone might come across that blog and think, this is the guy we need. But I would say it's pretty low percentage if you got a short-term need for a job.
Sure, sure. All right. Well, you've told us not to pay attention to the media about all the job stuff, but what is your take on the current job market?
Well, I consider myself a realistic optimist. Let me explain what I mean by that.
Realistic optimist.
A realistic optimist. So realism meaning, and this goes back to my engineering background, I do want to know the facts. I want the plain, as my mother would say, unvarnished truth. So the unvarnished truth is we're in one of the worst job markets in at least the last 30, or some statistics would argue the last 60 years. That's pretty much my lifetime. So I think people have to recognize that. Okay, fine. You don't want to sit around thinking about that all day. It just clouds your thinking and distracts you and makes you think, hey, I cannot succeed. But it is a bad job market. The average unemployment right now is about 7 months, which is the highest it's ever been. And frankly, I don't think it's likely to change in the foreseeable future. So that's the realistic part. So what, yeah. So sounds pretty bad, doesn't it?
So you don't see it improving anytime soon?
No. Not really, and I think if you read any of the recent reports of the economic forecasters from Georgia State or other places, they're saying pretty much the same thing. I mentioned at the last chapter of my book what I think is really going on in the job market, which is if any of you've read The Tipping Point or whatever, we've reached a tipping point in the market where I think we're sort of treading water. And maybe treading water for quite a while. So that's the bad news. The good news is people are getting hired every day. I see clients getting hired. I see other people getting hired. There's always a churn in the job market. People are leaving. Tim left. Tim had a great job. He decided to leave and go do this. Most of the time, that job will get backfilled. So what we have to think more now is not in terms of, I would say stop wishing for job creation and start thinking in terms of job churn and focus on being in front of people who, when somebody goes out the door, gets fired, quits, whatever it is, you're top of mind awareness with them.
But the average length of unemployment is 7 months, you said.
Right.
And so what's the stat for the 1 in 25 people who have a plan and of action and are doing some proactive things?
Well, I can't tell you for those people because I don't follow them through the process or anything. But my typical client, the numbers I've looked at is I try to shave at least 2 or 3 months off my typical client's job search, and that's how I return an ROI. If you look at the numbers, all you have to do is take $100,000 person. We're talking,
You say in 3 months in a job search, you've done something huge.
Yeah. Yeah. So in a good market, hopefully I'm going to shorten their job search and get them more money than they were making. In a weak market like now, it's really mostly about just getting the job search done faster.
So you guys talked about social media, LinkedIn. I know, Todd, you use Twitter a lot, and there's Facebook and all these social media tools. I want to talk a little bit more about technology before we close out this visit.
Okay.
Any wisdom, any experience, and any opinion, if you have one, on using like a video for doing like a video resume or an audio resume or something like that that's more multimedia?
Yeah, I do speak of that in the book. The book, it just came out.
See, if I'll buy the book, I don't even have to do the interview. It's all in there.
Exactly. Well, it's a great plug and a great lead-in. But the fact is, if you're going to be current and topical, you have to know what's going on. And what's going on in the marketplace is that Skip your question for a second, come back to it, is video and audio interviews and things like that are becoming more prevalent as a screening tool. For example, if I'm a recruiter, I could give five potential candidates a list of questions and get them to do a video or audio response to that and listen to it. And as we said, if only 7% of the words with the audio, I get the tonal inflection, the pauses, I get to hear how they actually communicate as opposed to a written response, and in real time. And with a video, I get to see all the body language. So I would say that's coming. It's growing. Now, getting to your question, I've seen a lot of job seeker videos, and they're mostly bad. Okay. They are not TV personalities. You know, if I was an anchor for the news, yeah, I'd produce a video because I'm going to look so slick. They're going to say, I need to hire this guy. He's great. But, you know, engineers, project managers, accountants, dentists, whatever you're talking about, I'm sorry, they don't look that good on video. So I'm not a fan of proactively providing video of yourself simply because when you look at it, it's usually not that professionally done. Mm. And even if you're good at it, you still have to have a reasonably professional production to not detract from your presentation.
Great point.
How does that sound?
Yeah, I think that's great advice. Makes a lot of sense.
Well, you have to use the medium that's appropriate. I mean, if you are an anchor on the news and you have that experience, yeah, that makes sense.
And
maybe
like
you
guys,
just do audio.
And like you guys, I mean, you know, you sound good. You know how to speak well. You've done a lot of radio. So you doing a promo, an audio promo, would look great. And
well, one of us would look good on video. So
well, the guy with the tie, yeah, Todd, you definitely okay. You definitely look much better today.
Well, how can our listeners get in touch with you and get their hands on this book?
Well, I have self-published so far. I am working literary agents and publishers. I'm not quite far along as Tim is, but they can buy the book on my website. I do have a website set up. It's fasttrackyourjobsearch.com. So the book title is Fast Track Your Job Search. So you just cram all that together. fasttrackyourjobsearch.com. They can. The best way to find me is on the web at my website, my company's Executive Impact. And if you put a dash or hyphen between those, kind of like with Tim, it's executive-impact.com.
Well, it has been an absolute delight having you on the show, and we are just about out of time. But before we let you go, you saw us ask our first guest this question, and we'd like to get you to do it as well, if you would, to share a mistake that you've made at some point in your career and what you feel like you learned from it.
I'll be happy to, now that it's fairly far behind me. I do have stories in my book of clients and what they've done to get jobs, and I think that's important that I hadn't mentioned. And actually, most of them are successes. One of the stories in the book that's kind of about a failure is my own, where I went ahead and admitted I have made a mistake in life. And I had courted an executive recruiter for almost 2 years, and I had schmoozed this guy, as they say, forever. And he finally got a job that was going to be a major step forward for me, and he got me plugged in and he got me an interview. And unfortunately, it's described more in the book, but basically I got overconfident. I got the big head, and I went into the interview. I've always been very confident, but I became overconfident. I crossed the line. And basically, I really blew the interview because this was an opportunity where I could have made a major leap forward in my career, and I'd built up to it for a year and a half, and I basically messed it up.
Ouch.
Yeah, so what could have happened from there? Who knows? I went on about my own way as a sort of a guerrilla networking careerist, and I did fine, and I reached the pinnacle of my career right before I started doing this. But what I learned from it was that it's good to be confident. There's a line, and you never want to cross that line over to overconfidence.
That's
you hear that advice a lot. Be confident, but not cocky.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
That is tremendous advice. Well, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Well, you're welcome. I've had a great time. It was great to meet you guys, and I appreciate you giving me the time to come talk.
You are more than
it's
welcome.
It's our pleasure.
That was a lot of fun. That was fun, wasn't it, Todd?
Sure was.
Well, until next time, this is Richard Kirby, Tim Link, Todd Schnick, our producer Lee Cantor, and the entire Radio X family saying we'll see you in the fast lane.